And welcome to week five. Week five, the beginning of chapter 2 of Ezra. For anyone who doesn't have the sheets, I think I still see some on top of the case that has the Tanakhs. And really, chapters 2 and 3 go together as they describe the Jewish return to the land. In chapter 1, we saw the decree that Koresh, that Cyrus, issued. We saw the apparent supportive response that comes from the nations surrounding the Jews. And now we find out just who went, and we're going to name names. I gave you on the handout, I gave you the outline of chapters 2 and 3, and we'll see, but you can take a look quickly down the outline. It's going to begin with a couple of sentences of introduction. We'll get a sentence of Yisraelim. Yisraelim generally is used to refer to Jews who are not Kohanim, who are not Leviim. In other words, they're not from the tribe of Levi. We get the Yisraelim first, then we get the Kohanim and Levites, then we get people with problematic lineage, as in, I know I'm a Kohen, but I can't prove it. That kind of situation. We'll find out about Nitinim as well. All sorts of interesting groups. Nitinim, as you'll see. Or you can just look ahead at the end of chapter 2. You'll see it there. Then we get the totals, followed by the first steps into the new land, what they begin to do, and what happens in year 2 after their return. All of this, again, as we've said, before Ezra ever shows up on the scene, although we may meet a close family member of his in this section. The themes that we're going to see in chapters 2 and 3 are the post-exile challenge of Jewish identity. Who is a Jew is going to crop up. You know, it ain't a new problem. The issue of restoring the temple service. How do you do it? What exactly is going to happen in the Beit HaMikdash, in this temple? And the issue of triumph and disappointment. Triumph, we're back, we're in the land, we have control, we've been told we can build a temple. But on the other hand, it's not going to match what they either remember personally or have heard about from 70 years prior. So those are going to be the themes that we have to contend with in chapters 2 and 3. But I wanted to take a minute first to introduce somebody by the name of Zerubbabel. Last time we introduced Shesh Batzar, who was described as Nisi Yehuda, the leader of Yehuda, who was given the vessels by Koresh, by Cyrus. But we're going to encounter here another leader by the name of Zerubbabel. And not only is he important in terms of, yes, Ma'oz Tzur, Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel, but actually in terms of, you know, history. So in terms of who Zerubbabel was, if you take a look in your Tanakh, I gave you the references for the verses that I want on your sheet so you can see it. Take a look at Divrei HaYamim Aleph, Chronicles 1, Chapter 3, Sentences 17 to 19. It is on page 1881, thank you. In the middle of giving us the descendants of the families of Yehuda, Judah, the fourth son of Yaakov. So here, actually, Yehuda's going to be there also, but the Yehuda's here and Yehuda's there. Fine. These are the descendants of King David, so it's a more narrow thing. It's the narrower line. So beginning in Pasuk Yud Zayin, in sentence 17, we're told of the sons of Yechoniah. And specifically, Yechoniah's sons are Asir, Sha'altiel, Malkiram, Hidayah, Shenatzar. Shenatzar, we said last time, may be Shesh Batzar. They may be the same person. Yekamya, Hoshama, Nedavya. That's your list of the sons of Yechoniah. And as Ralph said to me as we were sitting here before starting, you know, why don't people use these names anymore? Some of these names have a real ring. Others do not. But that's your list of the sons of Yechoniah. And then Pedaiah is one of his sons. Pedaiah has kids, and one of them, the first one listed, is Zerubbabel. Right? Zerubbabel then is a grandson of Yechaniah. Now remember who Yechaniah was. Yechaniah is also known by the name of Jehoiachin. He was the penultimate king of Judea. He was the one who Nebuchadnezzar took to Babylon with the Chereshu Masger, the leaders of the Jewish people, leaving the base Hamikdash, leaving the temple intact. He replaced Yechaniah with Zedekiah. But Yechaniah goes into exile. So that means that this fellow Zerubbabel, according to this, is a grandson of a king. He is part of the royal line. Now, there is a little bit of a problem in this regard, and that is if you take a look at Ezra Paragimel, Ezra chapter 3, sentence 2. So, if you were to go back to page 1819, chapter 3, sentence 2, when we actually mention who Zerubbabel's family is, Zerubbabel is introduced to us as the son of, chapter 3, sentence 2 in Ezra, Shealtiel, who was Pedaiah's brother. In other words, neither one is going to change the fact that he's a grandson of Yechaniah and part of the royal family. The only question is, how is he a grandson of the royal family? Is he through Pedaiah or is he through Shealtiel? Either way, he's part of the family. So when we get to this line in chapter 3, we'll have to talk about some of the solutions that are offered. But he's either the son of Pedaiah, son of Yechaniah, or the son of Shealtiel, son of Yechaniah. Yeah.
In other
words, couldn't the two of them both have kids named Zerubbabel? Yeah, I guess the only question would then be, if that's really true, why is it that the one who is the son of Pedaiah is mentioned, but not the one who's going to be the governor of Judea? You know, I would have expected him to be the one who's mentioned. But you're right, especially because, as we'll see, one of the etymologies that's suggested for Zerubbabel just is child of Babylon, as in the one who was born in Babel. Well, more than one person can claim that. So it certainly would not be odd in that sense. So he is royal, and that's something that we need to keep in mind. In terms of his age, I found this fascinating. This is one of those things that I didn't hear about when I was growing up, and I wish I had known about. It's been known for 100 years. It's not like it wasn't around. And yet, I never learned about it. But boy, is it fascinating to know. This is something called, I wrote it on, I included it in number 3, Jehoiachin's Rations Tablets. You ever hear about this? Jehoiachin's Rations Tablets. It's a shopping list, essentially. It's not really a shopping list, it's a list of food. What it is something that was discovered about 100 years ago in an archive room in Babylon. It is an archive of Nebuchadnezzar's records. And what it has, these rations tablets, what they have is actually the list of food to be provided by the Babylonian government to Jehoiachin and to his 5 sons. I love stuff like that. Like, how could I grow up not knowing that? But I didn't know it. Encyclopedia Micrae mentioned it, so now I know. But take a look at number 3. I told this, you can find it in a few places. This is the text from one of the tablets. 10 sillah of oil to the king of Judah, Jehoiachin. Then 2.5 sillah to the offspring of the king, 4 sillah to 8 men from Judea, 1.5 sillah for 3 carpenters from Arvad, can't forget them. And so on down the line, the different quantities that they give out, but it lists for us, it mentions the 5 sons. Now, the reason why this is important, besides being, you know, a corroboration of of our account of our next to last king and of his sons, and you know, that's valuable in its own right, but also it's from the 13th year of Nebuchadnezzar, which is the year 592 before the Common Era. And it says that Jehoiachin has 5 sons. Well, if Zerubbabel is the son of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel, we know, is the oldest of the sons, because he was first in the order, and we assume when you list somebody first, that means that he is the oldest. So that means that Shealtiel was already born, clearly, and old enough that he had 4 younger siblings, by the year 592, before the Common Era. Now, we're working here within the secular chronology rather than the Seder Olam chronology. But we are now, at this stage in the book of Ezra, in the year 539, before the Common Era. So what that means is Zerubbabel at this point could be in his 50s. He could be younger also. We don't know how old Shealtiel is when Zerubbabel is born. Sorry? 539 before the Common Era at this stage. That's based on that being the year when Cyrus conquers Babylon, because we said in the first year is when he sends the Jews back. That's where we get the idea that it's the year 539. So Zerubbabel could be as old as in his 50s. His uncles at this point could have passed on, which would explain why he becomes the leader. In other words, why is Zerubbabel the governor? The answer is he may be the most senior male from the royal line. That may be why he's around. In any case, Zerubbabel is then a member of the royal line, maybe the last, maybe most senior living member of the royal line. But the main problem that you have to deal with when you see Zerubbabel here is that he seems to be doing the same thing as Sheshbatzar at the same time. Meaning Sheshbatzar, we are told, got the vessels and brought them back. And we are going to find out, we already mentioned it last week, that Sheshbatzar is the one who lays the groundwork for the temple. But Zerubbabel is going to be listed here as leading the Jews in their return. So my question is, how do you have these two leaders functioning at the same time? Zerubbabel is going to be the pacha, the pacha. So how do we deal with this problem? So Susan suggests
the same person.
Right. So one approach is that they're the same person. We've already seen, I think, Ibn Ezra say this. Ibn Ezra's approach, he says it a couple of times in the first two chapters of Ezra. He says it in his comments to Daniel as well, that Sheshbatzar and Zerubbabel are the same person. He suggests maybe one name is a Hebrew name, one name is a Babylonian name. That's one suggestion. Ari?
Well, it could be that Zerubbabel was the governor and this guy was his treasurer, you know, in charge of doing the work.
It could be. You could try to identify different roles. It doesn't work so well as we go through it. The other possibility, yeah.
Later on, there are two leaders.
Right, but they have very different roles. Ezra and Nehemiah are wildly different people. Meaning Ezra is cast from the start as a scribe, as a religious leader. Nehemiah is a government functionary. They don't overlap in terms of the capacities in which they serve. You know, the same way that we're going to see Zerubbabel functioning alongside Yeshua Kohen Gadol, or Yeshua Kohen Gadol. They have different domains. Here, it really sounds like they're doing the same thing. It's very hard to distinguish. Yeah. So the other answer is that Sheshbatzar passes away early on. Sheshbatzar is there in the beginning. He's there long enough to lay the foundation, but then he's gone and Zerubbabel takes over, and that may well be. Interestingly, the Talmud has a different assumption. Take a look at source number 4. This is always interesting. Yechaniah has a curse recorded in Tanakh that he shall not have children, which we know he did, right? We have a list. Not only do we have a list, but the Babylonians have a list. So what happens? The Talmud says that God decides to repeal this curse and he can have kids. So in number 4 we find they parse the names of his kids. Shealtiel, Shenish'al al-Alato, Kael. Shealtiel is written in the Talmud there without one of the Alephs. That's why it may look funny to you. But Shealtiel, Shenish'al al-Alato Kael, it means Hashem repealed his vow. Zerubbabel, Shenizra bibavel, Zerubbabel means that he was conceived in Babylon. Umashemo, but what's his name? Nehemiah ben Hakal Yeshmo. His name is Nehemiah. In other words, according to this, Zerubbabel is not a grandson of Yechaniah. Zerubbabel is a son of Yechaniah. He's also known as Shealtiel, and he's also known as Nehemiah. Our Nehemiah. Same person. Zerubbabel equals Nehemiah.
Why was his father killed?
So I don't remember the whole discussion. I remember the whole piece there at the end of Malachim, but ostensibly it's a punishment. But no, that's a prophet. That's a whole other story.
Okay.
We have enough confusing stories right here. Thank you.
Hosea.
Yes. Yes. So it's not clear that this is meant literally in the Gemara. I mean, the Gemara does this, where it'll link people together and say, oh, this person is that person, in order to teach a lesson. Rashi on Zechariah in chapter 3 does in fact take it that way. Ibn Ezra in Zechariah does not take it that way. Abarbanel does not take it that way either. But one thing that I thought was particularly interesting that was relevant to that is source number 5. Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, writing in the 19th century, Chassidish, says the following: Kvar hitchila giloy or malazu al yedei Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel shehu mizera David hamelech alav hashalom. He's talking at the light of redemption, and he says the revelation of the light of above, the celestial light, began via Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, who was descendant of King David. V'hu Nehemiah ben Chakalia. He is Nehemiah, son of Chakalia, and he quotes our Gemara. V'nikra Zerubbabel shenizra b'Babel. He's called Zerubbabel because he's conceived in Babel. But now he explains the significance. Why would I name somebody, this person was seated, was conceived in Babel? What are you trying to accomplish by that? He explains. V'hainu liyos hu ikar hagoel mi Babel. The point is for the main redeemer to be someone from Babylon. V'u'al derech sh'amru al pasuk sh'am yireh egel al mashiach sh'gadal imam b'medina k'moshe rabbeinu alav ha'shalom b'paltin mitzrayim. He says the idea is, just like Moshe has to come from Egypt, he cannot be an outsider. He has to have grown up in the land. So too, the Redeemer of the Jews who will lead them out of Babylon has to have grown up in Babylon. And the idea is, Dela'olam ha-goel humi gidulei medinas ha-galus davka. He says the Redeemer has to come from the land where the exile took place. In order for you to be able to pull the nation out, you have to be from there. That's the idea there. It's a very Hasidic idea. But that's what he sees in this Gemara that's trying to tell us that Nehemiah is Zerubbabel, and that we want to emphasize him coming from Babel is because it had a lesson to teach me about how you get out of this position of suffering. It has to be someone who has known the suffering. It has to be somebody who is from there who can lead us out. Clear? Okay. So Zerubbabel is going to be a focal point for the transition for the Jewish people, not only in terms of our return and leading our return, but in terms of something else. Let me ask you, what's the state of mind of your average Jew who's coming out of Babylon in terms of what it is that they're trying to build? What does the average Jew at that point think they're trying to build when they return to Judea? Trying to build a temple and the old way of life. What does the old way of life mean?
Going to Jerusalem.
Going to Jerusalem, being able to go to Jerusalem. What else?
Get their land.
Get their land.
The religion, so as I said earlier, had been primarily based on sacrificing in Jerusalem, and now they've been cut off from that.
Right.
How about
getting restored laws of Torah?
Restoring the laws of Torah, restoring the central sacrificial system, but Ari throws in a new idea.
The kings.
How do you think Cyrus is going to feel about that? Right? Cyrus is more than glad to appoint a governor. Having a Jewish king is another story. And that's something to watch with Zerubbabel. Right now, Zerubbabel, whether he is Nehemiah, is not Nehemiah, is Sheish Batzar, is not Sheish Batzar, Zerubbabel is an appointee of the king, licensed by the king to do a particular job. Turn, please, to Haggai, chapter 2, sentence 23. You have to go backwards now. Haggai. H-A-G-G-A-I, right? It's a Scottish thing. Right? So Haggai is on page 1405. It's the last sentence in Haggai. Remember that Haggai is a prophet in the beginning of the Second Temple. We're going to read about him later. And he declares, the very bottom of page 1405, on that day, this is the word of Hashem, I will take you, Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel, right, my servant, v'samticha kachosam, I will make you like my signet ring. There are different explanations for what that means. I'm not going to go into that right now. Because you I have selected, this is the word of God. Who is Zerubbabel's boss now? Who is Zerubbabel's boss?
Governor of Judea.
Cyrus is his boss? Who's his boss in the pasuk?
He's the
I think the camera's ringing. Let it be.
He's the boss.
Sorry? Hashem, right? God is going to be his boss now. Take a look at Zechariah chapter 4. I think that take a look at Zechariah chapter 4. It's on page 1411. Sentences 6 to 9. And look at what Zechariah says. He hears from an angel.
What page?
It's page 1411. Sentence 6. You can see it. I listed it on your sheet, in number 6 on your sheet. Okay, the angel says to Zechariah, this is the word of Hashem to Zerubbabel, saying, not by armies, not by strength through my spirit. Who are you, great mountain, before Zerubbabel? You will become a plain. He will bring out the cornerstone with cheers of Chein, Chein, La. This vision, which, by the way, will be read in shul in just a few weeks, it's the Haftarah for Hanukkah, pictures Zerubbabel as what? The Redeemer, Zerubbabel is a Mashiach figure now. He's no longer working for Cyrus, right? Now he's working for God. So that's something to watch as we go along, because it marks not only an evolution of the role of Zerubbabel, but an evolution of the way the Jews are going to look at themselves. Will we see ourselves as exiles who have been allowed to come back to their land, but are going to live as Persian citizens? Or are we going to see ourselves as restoring the monarchy of the Jewish people, restoring our empire? So keep that in mind as we go along. It's going to relate also to something that happens to Zerubbabel in just a few chapters. So, okay. We now have seen the structure of the chapters and the we've learned a little bit about Zerubbabel. So let's start reading. Ezra chapter 2, beginning of the chapter. Sentences 1 and 2 are our opening verses. Anybody have a page number in the Stone Tanakh for this?
1814.
Thank you. Okay. 1815. Ve'ele b'nei ha'medina ha'olim mishavi ha'gola. These are the residents of the Medina. We have to come back to what that Medina is. Who ascended from captivity. Asher eglon Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel, who had been exiled by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Bavel, libavel, to Bavel. Vayashuvu Yerushalayim v'Yehuda ish le'iro. They returned to Jerusalem, to Judea, each one to his city. Asher bo im Zerubbabel. The following people came with Zerubbabel. Yeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Re'elayah, Mordechai, Bilshan, Mispar, Bigvai, Rechum, Ba'ana. Those are your names. Mispar Anshei Am Yisrael, the number of the Jewish people, is actually an introduction to the next verse. The last words of that sentence, this is something that you see once you get into this period in history, is that parts of Psukim are actually meant to introduce what comes next. For those who have learned Daniel, you see it there as well. So just those two sentences, what questions come to mind as you read those sentences? There are some things there that are odd, or that should trigger questions.
Zerubbabel and Nehemiah are two separate people here.
Yeah, so those who want to make Zerubbabel Nehemiah may say this is actually a different Nehemiah, which it likely is, because this Nehemiah is coming back to the land, and Nehemiah, who we're going to read about later, is still in Babel. Yeah. Is it a different Mordechai? Well, no. I mean, talk about how that could work. Yeah. What about Bilshan? One second. What about Bilshan?
Well, it's the first thing I thought was Shushan, but I think it's Shushan here has. I read the note.
You read the note. Disqualified. Okay. Sorry, Rebecca. Make the chronology work one way or the other. Does it make sense for him to be the Purim of Mordechai?
Well, Mordechai, sure, I love your Yerushalayim. And if he was taken out of Yerushalayim, we don't. Mordechai goes on in our story, in our little, you know, Esther bit, that he takes, you know, he becomes, you know, a right hand man.
Yeah.
Well, the chronology doesn't really work.
Well, it can. In other words, the story of Esther is supposed to take place during the period after they're halted, right? The Jews are going to come back to the land. They're going to meet opposition in building the temple. They're going to be told, okay, stop building the temple. And in that period, before it starts again, that's supposedly when we're going to see Esther. We have to discuss that chronology more when we actually get to the story. But it's possible, yes, that there is a Mordechai who returns to the land here with Zerubbabel, and then lands back in Persia, in Shushan. Remember, Ralph just pointed out, there's a Nehemiah on this list also. Some are going to suggest that that's actually the Nehemiah we'll meet later, even though the Nehemiah we'll meet later, once again, is in Persia. He's not in Israel. There's going to be another name like that in this sentence as well. That's not the sum of it. What other questions or thoughts come up as you read these opening two sentences?
What's the relation of these
well, this
names
isn't the whole list.
To all the rest of the
right. So what? Right. Who are these people? Who are these people that they should be listed in the beginning? They seem like they are allies of Zerubbabel. He can't do everything himself. Right? So these are his partners. These are the people who are going to be the officials in charge of the group. These look like these are leaders. How about the fact that it says the people who were exiled by the king of Babel to Babel?
It wasn't him.
Sorry? What?
They weren't exiled by him.
No, it's
but he wasn't exiled.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. These are the people who, right? They came with. One second. Yeah. Who ascended from the captivity, which was created by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, to Babel. I wasn't aware that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, was in the practice of exiling people to, I don't know, South Africa. Like, where else would they be?
Yes.
What are you adding here? Yeah.
In English, it's redundant, but.
I mean, Hebrew also.
I don't think it's redundant at all.
Yeah?
Okay. I don't see a redundancy. He's identifying Nebuchadnezzar.
Where else would they have been sent?
Sometimes
yeah, but they're all in Babel.
No, because this may have been near the capital of Babel, close to
him. Ah, so good. Dalia points out, this is a key point, Babel is not only the name of the empire, Babel is the city.
Right.
The capital city of the Babylonian Empire is named Babylon. For those, again, who did Sefer Daniel, when Nebuchadnezzar is walking around on his roof and he admires the great Babel, it doesn't mean he's looking out and seeing his entire empire. He's looking at his capital city. That's what he's admiring. So that's something that I think is important to recognize.
Born in Babylon. He wasn't really exiled, as I was saying before.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Born after the exile.
Correct. But the opening line here isn't about him per se. It's about the exile that was created by Nebuchadnezzar. But you're right, not him personally. Another question here. Where is Sheshbazzar? If these are the leaders who are working with sorry? Don't quote me to answer my question. I'm asking the question. Where is? And the answer may be the same person, or he may be died. But notice that he's not here. In the previous chapter, we said Sheshbazzar, you're in charge. But then we get to the census. Zerubbabel, you're in charge, and Sheshbazzar is nowhere to be seen. That's the odd thing. Not to mention, we mentioned here that they are returning to their cities. Do we think those cities have been vacant for 70 years?
It's
his own city.
You're
yeah.
Sorry?
Yes, it's his own city.
Right, well, each, because...
Yeah, but it's only means it's a popular area. Yeah. This is where I come from.
Yeah.
I come from Philadelphia.
Right, but keeping in mind that these would have been Jewish-dominated cities, and then they were exiled by the Babylonians, who's living there now? each one goes back to his city to find what? So that's something we have to keep in mind.
There was a nucleus left behind.
About getting it exact. So if you said that, when you say where is what you say, but or something, maybe you didn't go with them. I mean, because you're being very exacting in wanting this all to be almost historically correct. Which
so far the data is pretty good.
Yeah, but in terms of what exactly happened, we know the numbers aren't complete. I mean, that kind of thing.
Right.
Is this a historical record, or is this kind of a...
Right. So I'm going to go back to something which enough of the scholars said and regarding this book and others. I'll go back to Newsom regarding Eov as well, which is the assumption that it doesn't work has to be my last assumption, not my first. It could be that I'm going to encounter something that isn't going to work. For example, we're going to have to figure out the fact that this census actually appears twice. It appears in Ezra 2, and it's going to appear in Nehemiah 7, and the numbers aren't going to be the same. Some of the names are going to change, some of the numbers are going to change. And we have to ask, well, does that mean that the record is simply corrupted? Does it mean that this is simply not right? But it would be lazy for me to take that as my first option. I'm first going to find a way that things can work, and if they can't, if at the end I can't resolve it, then the answer is okay. So there's a mistake here, but that's not going to be option number one for me. Yeah.
Okay. Nebuchadnezzar exiled the Jews. It says here the Bible. Okay, we can say it's a city. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that all the Jews he exiled from Israel went there. He could have spread them around his whole empire.
Right, so the thing...
So then when people are coming back, some may come from Babel, and some of the people who came back could have come from other places as well.
Right.
Within the empire.
Right.
So where does that leave us in terms of people's names and whatever? Maybe a person who's not listed here didn't come from Babel, but came from another area within the empire.
Right. So that's entirely possible. I mean, the initial point was to say that the exiling to Babel meant the exiling to the city, to the capital. In other words, these are people who were exiled to the capital as opposed to people who were exiled to the empire. But you're right. There could be Jews who return who are not from the capital city.
It would seem only fair on the part of the king who's allowing them to go back that he doesn't restrict the Jews that go back only from this.
Oh, no, he was very clear. He was actually very clear. The opening sentence in Ezra said he passed the decree, B'chol Malchuso, through his entire kingdom. So 100% true. You're right. We are only getting the returnees from the capital city. Mind you, it's the major center, and it's where I'm going to find the royal line, for example. And that I'm going to come back to in a moment from the Malvin. But you're right. There could be others who are not going to be listed here because they came separately.
Two things that are connected. One is, obviously, if we're saying Zerubbabel is around 50 years old, and he was exiled, and he's part of the original exile to Babel, then he has...
I didn't say he's around 50. He could be as old as 50. He could be younger also. He's not one of the original exiles. Zerubbabel is not one of the original exiles. Zerubbabel is born in Babel. He's not born in... He is not one of the original exiles. That we know.
But doesn't this paragraph say those that were exiled?
No. It says they came from the Gola that was exiled by Nebuchadnezzar. In other words, they came from the exiled population. It's not that in order to return to Israel, you had to have been born there. That's not what it's saying. No. You follow?
Yeah, I follow. I guess the English translation is cool.
That could be. Okay, so let's tackle this straight because there are things that are being said that I think will fit better once we read it within the Pesukim. So first of all, these are the Bnei HaMedina. So which Medina do you mean? It could be past, present, or future. Different commentators take it in different ways. Rashi, Mitzudat David, say Medina means the past. It's from the land of Israel. These are the people who came from the land of Israel and who are now going to return. Ibn Ezra says it's the present, meaning it's Babylon. These are the people of Babylon who are returning. And then Dat Mikra, the edition that I use here, says it's actually future. It's the Medina of Judea. which isn't strange at all, because we're going to see later on in this book that Judea is called Yehud Medinta, the Medina of Judea. So that's not strange at all to think that it's talking about the future. Interesting note in terms of what B'nai HaMedina means. All terms require translation, evidently. All right.
Medina, have we seen that term before?
Well, we see it in works that are contemporary to this, like Esther. Medina o Medina, you know, is found there.
Before that.
Do we find it as an earlier term? Yeah. No, it's an interesting question.
It could be a Babylonian concept.
Mm-hmm. It's possible. Possible. Offhand, nothing's coming to mind. It's certainly not a Chumash term. The question is only, is it a later term than that, but before this period? And the answer is, I don't know. Yeah. Nothing comes to mind, though, with it. Interesting. So, the king of Bavel has exiled them to Bavel, which we've now noted is the capital city. But take a look at Malbim, which I brought you here in source number 7. Malbim says the following. Upo Omar Asher Hegla Nebuchadnezzar le Bavel. Here it says, the people who Nebuchadnezzar exiled to Babylon. Vishom Arstam Asher Hegla Nebuchadnezzar. However, Malbim notes that separately in the work of Esther, we talk about those who were exiled by Nebuchadnezzar, as opposed to who exiled to Bavel. Kipo diber me'osam, and elsewhere also we'll see that. Kipo diber me'osam shegalu begalus yechonya, she'em galu lebavel atzma le'ir amelucha. Because here we are speaking of those who were exiled in the exile of Yechonya, and they went to Babylon itself, meaning the capital city. Visham diber migalus tzidkiyahu shehegla el arei medina. The separate reference that he gives, where it doesn't say to Bavel, is talking about Tzidkiyahu's exile, and they went to the general cities of the land. The point here, and what we're trying to show here, what Malbim is trying to show, is that the people who are going to be listed here are the people who returned, who were from the aristocracy, from the Chereshu Masgir, from the people who were exiled with Yechonya, and that's why it emphasizes they went to Bavel. They went to Bavel, meaning, When Nebuchadnezzar's forces exiled the Jews, they took the elite and brought them to the elite city, the capital city, and they took the rest of the Jews in their later exile and brought them to, I don't know, you know, a Yellowknife or whatever. They put them somewhere that was not the capital. You follow? That's what he's describing. Okay. Each one goes back to his city, meaning they retain their identity. Just like they retain their tribal identity, apparently they retain knowledge of their city, and they want to go back there. And the people who come back are an interesting mix. Yeshua is going to become the Kohen Gadol. The first Kohen Gadol of the second Beis HaMikdash is this fellow, Yeshua ben Yehotzadak. But that hasn't happened yet. They don't have a Kohen Gadol at this stage. Right now, he's just Yeshua, who's significant, but not a Kohen Gadol. Nehemiah could be the Nehemiah, might not be. And then we get Seraya. Why is Seraya important? Anybody know who Seraya was? Or who he could be, I should say.
Ezra's father.
Could be Ezra's father. Ezra's father is going to be listed in chapter 7. His name is Seraya. This could be Ezra's father. This will go back to Rebecca's question of how that would work historically, because if he's coming back to the land now, why is his son Ezra still in Bavel? To which the answer may be, his son is grown. Seraya is making Aliyah, leaving his kids behind. Or it's possible that, again, Ezra goes and then comes back, although last week we noted a source indicating he never left. But you could offer all sorts of explanations, but Seraya may be Ezra's father. The reason why that's important is because we have a sense that the people coming with Zerubbabel are aristocracy. They're significant people, and that will give us a picture of Ezra as being somebody of some aristocratic lineage. Then you have this fellow, Re'elayah, And I haven't seen anything about who he might be, except that his name is going to be different when he shows up in Nehemiah 7. But that's really all I can tell you about Re'elayah. And then you have Mordechai or Mordechai Bilshan. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 8. Ibn Ezra says on this Mordechai Bilshan, who Mordechai HaYehudi? This is the Mordechai from Megillat Esther. Rak Bilshan yidachen shu ish acher. Bilshan is not part of his name. In other words, it's Seraya, Re'elaya, Mordechai, and then there's also somebody by the name of Bilshan. Ah, but why don't I have a vav? He says, yeah, because you don't have a vav. V'uchaser vav ke'adam sheis eno. She says, read the opening pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, which lists generations. We know there's no one by the name of Adam, Seth, Enosh, right? It's a list of generations. And for that matter, look at the list right here. None of them had vavs. Right? Look at our own list in the pasuk. There are no ands. There are, it's, you know, name. So Mordechai and Bilshan are two different people. Now, if you haven't read the Gemara before, you might ask, why did Ibn Ezra even need to say that? Why wasn't it obvious that there's Mordechai and there's Bilshan? And the answer is because I have a Gemara that thinks differently. Source number 9, the second side of the sheet. Have a Bayil Lishnei Vidarish, that Mordechai of the Purim story, that Mordechai could mix up language and interpret it and explain it, meaning he was able to understand hints, codes, in people's words. V'ayinu dechsiv b'Mordechai Bilshan, and that's why it says of Mordechai that he is Bilshan. Bilshan is somebody, according to this, who can explain and figure things out. So Gita says, from Lashon? Are you sure?
No?
Come on, what else is it playing on with the word Bilshan? It's a modern Hebrew word.
Balash.
Balash, which is?
A detective.
Right? Balash or Balshan is a term for a detective. To be Bolesh is either to be it's either to detect or alternatively, it's the tax guy who checks things at the border, the customs guy who wants to make sure to check your bags for anything that's hidden in there. That's the Bolesh. That's a play. It's used today as a play also by language. There's a language blog or column, I forget, Balashon uses the Bolesh reference. But this, of course, is linked to what idea from the Book of Esther? Mordechai knowing languages? Right, the story of Bigtan and Teresh. How does Mordechai find out that Bigtan and Teresh are plotting against the king? Because he heard them speaking in their language and he understood what they were talking about. Yes, Rosheva.
Hey, sorry, I hope I'm not throwing this off, but are we all disturbed by the word B'nei HaMedina? Like, why didn't say Anshei HaMedina? In other words, why are we calling it the sons? Why does it refer to the Zanshay? And I'm just wondering, is it supposed to parallel like when Yaakov came, like Elish Shemuth? Like, is that the idea that now these are people returning? Or are we? Or is there something about that these are the people who were born elsewhere and sort of like are considered
right
from a whole other place?
Right. So Elisheva asks, what is the significance of calling them B'nei HaMedina? Does that, you know, should that bother us? And maybe that is the driver behind the debate about B'nei HaMedina, and whether Medina refers to Bavel, whether Medina refers to older Israel or the new Judea being formed, that by giving them such a close association, B'nei HaMedina, what we're trying to say is not Bavel, but we're actually referring to the place to which they are going, that it's Israel. Maybe that's an influencing factor. I hadn't thought about it, but maybe that would be the approach. He says what? No. You have to read it. What is he? Don't read it aloud. Just tell me what he's saying.
That these were big, famous people.
Yeah.
And they and others, how you meshuchim, and they were other meshuchim acharim, but all came min nucham.
Right. Now, Rashi is trying to show there is just that these people are enumerated specifically because they're aristocracy. He's not picking up on the B'nai HaMedina question that Elisheva is noting. His point is a separate one. Okay. So, you have this Mordechai who, you know, both Ibn Ezra and the Gemara believe is Mordechai of the Purim story. The only question is Bilshan part of his name? and it's indicating his language skills, or is this a separate person? You have this fellow Mispar, which is a name. The Mispar is the name. Bigvai, which apparently there's a fellow by the name of Bagohi who would later be a governor in Judea. So the name may be popular. Yeah. Right, so that's what I'm saying. There's no need for there to be a vav. Right, no. Right, no, it's not. There's Rechum, which is a name that shows up quite a bit. It was a popular name. And then there's Ba'ana, which we'll also see in a couple of different places. So these are the people who are allies of Zerubbabel who are leading the charge. And then Mispar Anshei Am Yisrael, we're now going to see the rest of the population, which brings us to the name list. The list of all these people who came from Bavel to return to the land. So I already introduced the concept of name lists when I introduced Ezra and Nehemiah all together. But a couple of notes on this. First of all, as I already noted, this list will appear again in the seventh chapter of Nehemiah with some variations. We'll have to talk about the variations when we get to Nehemiah 7. Encyclopedia Mikra'it makes the contention that this list is the original list. Meaning that what he's trying to say is that there are allegations made from time to time that lists are sort of retrofitted based on names that the people have access to later. And he says it can't be for this list. And he brings a couple of proofs to it. For example, we're going to see a family named the Hakotz family. It's going to be in sentences 61, 62. They will be listed as being excluded from the Kehuna because they can't prove their lineage. However, we will find them later on in Ezra and then in Nehemiah as important citizens. So you wouldn't make sense for later for somebody, if you were retrofitting this in, you wouldn't have said they were removed from the Kehuna if you're writing at a time when they're actually significant, when they've gained status. It's also going to mention that there's no Kohen Gadol yet. And of course, later they would have a Kohen Gadol. We're going to see them list animals, but it's going to list travel animals, not agricultural animals. So the list seems, the clues are that this list is actually written down at the time when they are making the journey. Ralph?
There are names that are recognizable as places. So might these people be from that place originally?
Yes. Yes.
And they're going back there?
Yes. The commentators talk about this issue. The commentators talk about this issue and say that some of them are listed based on family line and some of them are based are listed based on place. You are correct. Janine, what was the...
back to the Dinah. It seems to me obvious that it is Eretz Yisrael, that the Dinah is Israel.
Because?
Well, first of all, the name is Dinah, and also
Rashi... I mean, you have Rashi on your side. Yeah. It's just that Ibn Ezra is again, so the question is now why?
When I read it, immediately, I thought... Right.
Well, no, Bavel is called Bavel Medinta. Bavel Medinta is used in Tanakh.
Yeah. And in Esther, you have him sending letters, Medina, Medina.
Yeah.
So he's sending to all of
Right. And there are a couple of places in Tanakh. There's one, I think, I have this vague memory of Medinat Patros, but I have to go back and look it up. Like, you find it in later Nevi'im. It's not entirely unique to this. So what is the role of this list? We're going to see a whole lot of names. We're going to speed through most of them, frankly. We'll pick on a couple of them that have particular points. But what is the role of the of this list? So I mentioned in introducing the class, I mentioned an article by Rabbi Chaim Angel on the name lists. And I wanted to pick out two ideas that he talks about. One is that the goal of the name list is to emphasize the importance of the people involved. He notes that one of the, if not the most, then one of the most important topics in Chumash, based on real estate assigned to it, is the building of the Mishkan. Right? We get a tremendous amount of space on the plans for building it, the fact that they built it, what would go on within it. Then you get into the Navi, and you find in Malachim, in the Book of Kings, you find, again, a lot of real estate devoted to the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple. right? A couple of chapters of where the materials came from, how much came from, what they did with it. When you read Ezra, there's going to be almost nothing about the construction process. A little bit, but not anything resembling what you see in the with the Mishkan and what you see with the first Beis HaMikdash. And so he suggests the point is to de-emphasize the construction and instead emphasize the people. These are the people who came back, and we are going to give you this long, long list. This family came back, and this family came back, and this family came back. It sort of reminds me of Rashi in Shemot, which I actually did bring. I just flipped the order on the sheet. Take a look at source number 11, please. Rashi talks about the fact that at the end of Sefer Bereishit, we get the list of those who came down to Egypt. And then the book of Shemot begins again with a list of who came down to Egypt. So Rashi explains why. Even though he counted them when they were alive by name, Chazar umna'an b'misasan. He then counted them again when they died, meaning after they died. Lo diachi basan shenim shalula kochavim, to show how beloved they are. They're compared to the stars. Shemotzianu machnisan b'misparu b'shmosam, that God takes them out and he brings them back in by number, by name. They quote to the pasuk in Yeshaya to support that. So he says, so one way to look at it is you're counting them to show each one of these matters. Each one of these is significant, and therefore you're going to have to suffer through 60-something psukim of names because they matter to God. That's one way to look at it. And then there's another way to look at it. If you remember the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, right? Yaakov is preparing to meet Esav. How does he prepare to meet Esav?
He buys the camp.
Right. So he divides the camp in two, although that doesn't actually happen in the end. When you actually read the story, everybody is all together. Like, something went wrong in that division of the camp. I think it had to do with, I'm going to be in camp number two. No, I'm going to be in camp number... No. But he divides them up into camps that some could flee. He davens to Hashem, and he prepares a gift. And when he sends the gift, when you look at the way that he sends it, he gives them instructions about how they should present themselves, and he arranges all of them so that it's in independent units. This one is going to go, and then this one is going to go, and then this one is going to go. Vayitzav gamis harishon, gamis hasheni, gamis hashalishi. So Rashi, and it says, verevach tasimu bein eder uvein eder. He instructs them, put space in between each flock. Right? It's like a kid writing a term paper. Double space, triple space, the lines. That's what he's trying to do. Take a look at Rashi. It's in number 10 here. He says, "V'revach tasimu, you shall place space, eider lifnei chaveiro malo ayin, one flock in front of the next, out of sight, kedei lahasbia eino shel rasha, so as to fill the eye of Esav, ulataveyu al riboy hadaron, so that he'll be shocked by how big this gift is when, you know, it just keeps on coming. Every time he thinks he's seen it all, now there's more showing up." So Rabbi Angel suggests that it makes the list look longer. When you enumerate each one, it isn't just there were 42,000. It's, and then there was this, and then there was this, and then there was this. And that's one way to look at it. However, you could turn it on its head and say that it's actually the opposite. Look how small this group is. You can name them all. You know, if this was really a great big group, then you wouldn't be able to do this. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, that's in Zechariah. We find that where they actually do, you know, put down with names the item that's come for the Beis HaMikdash. But interesting. So you think everyone has to be named here as part of, you know? Yeah. Okay.
Could we look at it another way?
Yeah.
The question of mine came to my mind is, when this was written, who was it written for?
Right.
Now, if it's written for the people of the time, I think they're trying to write a message that impresses them of, look, who came up, where we settled, you know, we should be proud of what we've come from. and what we're accomplishing. We're reading it now a long time later, and we're trying to put it in a historical perspective that I don't think was the objective of when it was written.
Right. But I think you can still have both perspectives within that. In other words, I'm not talking about the historical, but I'm saying that you can have, addressing the people of the time, you could have both the positive and the negative.
Yes.
You know, both of those will make sense to them. So I agree with you that in general, if you canonize something in Tanakh, your goal is not only for people now to read it, your goal is to create something which will remain, because now we're going to write it up in our scrolls and we're going to put it away, and that's what the process of canonization is. But I think you're right that it's also meant to have this immediate impact on those who are there, and certainly that's what the first writing is for. I want to make sure to get to number 12, and we're running out of time with it, so I want to just read it through very quickly. One also might argue that the brevity of the account in Ezra and Nehemiah, meaning the account of building the temple, not the account of the names, coupled with the astonishing attention given to the people who arrived to rebuild the temple, suggests a different conclusion. The Torah and the Book of Kings highlight the physical structure of the sanctuaries and the heroes who built them. Now, in Ezra and Nehemiah, the people are at the center of the activity. As Tamara Cohn Eskenazi asserts, receiving literary endorsement by the inclusion of the lengthy name list in chapter 2, right? My name made it into Nehemiah. How cool is that? It is noteworthy that in chapter 3, the people initiated the temple construction. It comes from the people. When the seventh month arrived, the Israelites settled in their towns. The entire people assembled as one man in Jerusalem. Only then did Zerubbabel and Yeshua lead them. So that it's coming from the people. The people are the essence. The name list in Ezra 2 contributes significantly to an understanding of Ezra chapters 1 to 6. It gives the feeling of national unity in response to Cyrus's decree. It describes importance to each individual. It gives the people a more central role than their leaders or the temple. But it also insinuates that the number of returnees was considerably smaller than the prophets would have liked. Similar to the cacophony of the rejoicing and weeping described in Ezra chapter 3, the reader may perceive a blurring of joy and disappointment when reading this list of returnees. So the answer is both elements are here. So what we're suggesting here are really three ideas, and they're not contradictory. Idea number one, we list all the names in order to emphasize the people over the structure, because it's the people who make this happen, the ones who take the initiative to go. We emphasize the greatness of the returnees. Look, we have this nice long list. And yet also, at the same time, we recognize this is all we got. And therefore, there's actually something depressing, something disappointing about it. So next time, what we'll do is we'll go quickly through the census. I'm just going to pick out some of the names and some of the points that are to be made from it before we'll then run into the more interesting cases at the end of the census of the people with interesting lineage. So God willing, that will be next week. One note, because